Low cyanite long after. Into the drifting whiteness. Inan makes an exception for her that night. Later, sitting up in his captain's bed, Cyan says, I want to see Alia. Inan sighs.
No, you don't.
But he gives the order anyway, because he loves her. The ship charts a new course. According to legend, Father Earth did not originally hate life. In fact, as the lorists tell it, once upon a time, Earth did everything he could to facilitate the strange emergence of life on his surface. He crafted even, predictable seasons, kept changes of wind and wave and temperature slow enough that every living being could adapt, evolve, summoned waters that purified themselves, skies that always cleared after a storm. He did not create life, that was happenstance, but he was pleased and fascinated by it, and proud to nurture such strange, wild beauty upon his surface. Then people began to do horrible things to Father Earth. They poisoned waters beyond even his ability to cleanse, and killed much of the other life that lived on his surface. They drilled through the crust of his skin, past the blood of his mantle, to get at the sweet marrow of his bones. And at the height of human hubris and might, it was the Origins who did something that even Earth could not forgive. They destroyed his only child. No lorist that Cyanite has ever talked to knows what this cryptic phrase means. It isn't stone lore. Just oral tradition occasionally recorded on ephemerals like paper and hide, and too many seasons have changed it. Sometimes it's the Earth's favorite glass knife that the Origins destroyed. Sometimes it's his shadow. Sometimes it's his most valued breeder. Whatever the words mean, the lorists and mests agree on what happened after the Origins committed their great sin. Father Earth's surface cracked like an eggshell. Nearly every living thing died as his fury became manifest in the first and most terrible of the fifth seasons, the Shattering Season. Powerful as they were, those ancient people had no warning, no time to build store caches, and no stone lore to guide them. It is only through sheer luck that enough of humankind survived to replenish itself afterward. And never again has life attained the heights of power that it once held. Earth's recurrent fury will never allow that. Cyanite has always wondered about these tales. There's a degree of poetic license in them, of course. Primitive people trying to explain what they didn't understand. But all legends contain a kernel of truth. Maybe the ancient origins did shatter the planet's crust somehow. How, though? It's clear now that there's more to Orogeny than what the Fulcrum teaches, and maybe there's a reason the Fulcrum doesn't teach it, if the legend is true. But facts are facts. Even if somehow every origin in existence down to the infants could be yoked together, they could not destroy the world's surface. It would ice everything. There's not enough warmth or movement anywhere to do that much damage. They'd all burn themselves out trying and die. Which means that part of the tale can't be true. Orogeny cannot be to blame for the Earth's rage. Not that anyone but another Raga would accept this conclusion. It is truly amazing, though, that humanity managed to survive the fires of that first season. Because if the whole world was then as Alia is now, Cyanite has a fresh understanding of just how much Father Earth hates them all. Alia is a nightscape of red, blistering death. There is nothing left of the calm except the caldera ring that once cradled it, and even that is hard to see. Squinting through the red wavering haze, Cyan thinks she can glimpse a few leftover buildings and streets on the caldera's slopes. But that might just be wishful thinking. The night sky is thick with ash clouds, underlit by the glow of fire. Where the harbor was, there is now a growing volcano cone, gushing deadly clouds and hot red birth blood on its climb out of the sea. It's already huge, occupying nearly the entire caldera bowl, and it has already borne offspring. Two additional vents crouch against its flank, belching gas and lava like their parent. Likely all three will eventually grow together to become a single monster, engulfing the surrounding mountains and threatening every calm in range of its gas clouds or subsequent blows. Everyone Cyanite met in Alia is dead now. The claw suit can't go within 5 miles of the shore. Any closer and they risk death, whether by warping the ship's hull in the heated waters or by suffocating in the hot clouds that periodically gout forth from the mountain. Or by cooking themselves over one of the subsidiary vents that are still developing around the area, spreading out from what was once Alia's harbor like the spokes of a wheel, and lurking like deadly mines beneath the waters offshore. Cyan can assess every one of these hotspots, bright, churning rage storms just beneath the Earth's skin. Even Inan can assess them, and he steered the ship away from those that are most likely to burst through any time soon. But as fragile as the strata are right now, a new vent could open right under them before Cyan has a chance to detect or stop it. Inan's risking a lot to indulge her.
Many in the outlying parts of the calm manage to escape, Inan says softly beside her.
The Klausu's whole crew has come up on deck, staring at Alia in silence.
They say there was a flash of red light from the harbor, then a series of flashes in a rhythm, like something pulsing. But the initial concussion, when the whole damned harbor boiled away at once, flattened most of the smaller houses in the calm. That's what killed most people.
There was no warning. Cyanite twitches. No warning. There were almost 100,000 people in Alia, small by the standards of the Equatorials, but big for a coaster calm. Proud. Justifiably so. They'd had such hopes.
Rust this. Rust it and burn it in the foul, hateful guts of Father Earth.
Cyanite?
Inan is staring at her. This is because Cyan has raised her fists before her as if she is grasping the reins of a straining, eager horse. And because a narrow, high, tight torus has suddenly manifested around her. It isn't cold. There's plenty of earth power for her to tap nearby. But it is powerful, and even an untrained Raga can sense the gathering flex of her will. Inan inhales and takes a step back.
Cyan, what are you?
I can't leave it like this, she murmurs, almost to herself. The whole area is a swelling deadly boil ready to burst. The volcano is only the first warning. Most vents in the earth are tiny, convoluted things, struggling to escape through varying layers of rock and metal and their own inertia. They seep and cool and plug themselves, and then seep upward again, twisting and winding every which way in the process. This, though, is a gigantic lava tube, channeled straight up from wherever the garnet obelisk has gone, funneling pure earth hate toward the surface. If nothing is done, the whole region will soon blow sky high in a massive explosion that will almost surely touch off a season. She cannot believe the fulcrum has left things like this. So Cyanite stabs herself into that churning, building heat and tears at it with all the fury she feels at seeing Alia. This was Alia. This was a human place. There were people here. People who didn't deserve to die because of me. Because they were too stupid to let sleeping obelisks lie, or because they dared to dream of a future. No one deserves to die for that. It's almost easy. This is what origins do, after all.
and the hot spot is ripe for her use. The danger lies in not using it, really. If she takes in all that heat and force without channeling it elsewhere, it will destroy her. But fortunately, she laughs to herself and her whole body shakes with it. She's got a volcano to choke off. So she curls the fingers of one hand into a fist and sears down its throat with her awareness, not burning, but cooling, turning its own fury back on it to seal every breach. She forces the growing magma chamber back, back, down, down. And as she does so, she deliberately drags together the strata in overlapping patterns so that each will press down on the one below it and keep the magma down, at least until it finds another, slower way to wend its way to the surface. It's a delicate sort of operation. For all that it involves millions of tons of rock, and the sorts of pressures that force diamonds into existence. But Cyanite is a child of the Fulcrum, and the Fulcrum has trained her well. She opens her eyes to find herself in Inan's arms, with the ship heaving beneath her feet. Blinking in surprise, she looks up at Inan, whose eyes are wide and wild. He notices that she's back, and the expressions of relief and fear on his face are both heartening and sobering.
"I told everyone you would not kill us," he says over the churning of the sea spray and the shouts of his crew.
She looks around and sees them frantically trying to lower the sails so that they can have more control amid a sea that is suddenly anything but placid.
"Please try not to make me a liar, would you?"
Shit. She's used to working orogeny on land and forgot to account for the effects of her fault sealing on water. They were shakes for a good purpose, but shakes nonetheless, and, oh, Earth, she can feel it. She's touched off a tsunami, and she winces and groans as her sesapine set up a ringing protest at the back of her head. She's overdone it. Inan, her head is ringing, agony.
"You need, push waves of matching amplitude. Subsurface."
"What?" He looks away from her to shout something to one of the crewmen in his tongue, and she curses inwardly. Of course he has no idea what she's talking about. He does not speak Fulcrum. But then all at once, there is a chill in the air all around them. The wood of the ship groans with the temperature change. Cyan gasps in alarm, but it's not much of a change, really. Just the difference between a summer night and an autumn one, albeit over the span of minutes, and there is a presence to this change that is familiar as warm hands in the night. Inan abruptly inhales as he recognizes it too. Alabaster. Of course his range stretches this far. He quells the gathering waves in moments. When he's done, the ship sits on placid waters once more, facing the volcano of Alia, which has now gone quiet and dark. It's still smoking and will be hot for decades, but it no longer vents fresh magma or gas. The skies above are already clearing. Leshie, Inan's first mate, comes over, throwing an uneasy look at Cyanite. He says something too fast for Cyanite to translate fully, but she gets the gist of it. Tell her next time she decides to stop a volcano, get off the ship first. Leshier's right. "Sorry," Cyan mutters in Eterpic, and the man grumbles and stumbles off. Inan shakes his head and lets her go, calling for the sails to be unfurled once again. He glances down at her.
"You all right?"
"Fine." She rubs at her head. "Just never worked anything that big before."
"I did not think you could. I thought only ones like Alabaster, with many rings more than yours, could do so. But you are as powerful as he."
"No." Cyanite laughs a little, gripping the railing and clinging to it so she won't need to lean on him for support anymore. "I just do what's possible. He rewrites the rusting laws of nature.
Inan sounds odd, and Cyanite glances at him in surprise, to see an almost regretful look on his face.
Sometimes, when I see what you and he can do, I wish I had gone to this fulcrum of yours.
No, you don't. She doesn't even want to think about what he would be like if he'd grown up in captivity with the rest of them. Inan. But without his booming laugh or vivacious hedonism or cheerful confidence. Inan, with his graceful, strong hands, weaker and clumsier for having been broken. Not Inan.
He smiles ruefully at her now, as if he has guessed her thoughts.
Someday, you must tell me what it's like there. Why all who come out of that place seem so very competent and so very afraid.
With that, he pats her back and heads off to oversee the course change. But Cyanite stays where she is at the railing, suddenly chilled to the bone in a way that has nothing to do with the passing flex of Alabaster's power. That is because, as the ship tilts to one side in its turnabout, and she takes one last look back at the place that was Alia before her folly destroyed it, she sees someone.
Or she thinks she does. She's not sure at first. She squints and can just make out one of the paler strips that wend down into the Alia bowl on its southern curve, which is more readily visible now that the ruddy light around the volcano has faded. It's obviously not the Imperial Road that she and Bastar traveled to get to Alia once upon a time and one colossal mistake ago. Most likely what she's looking at is just a dirt road used by the locals, carved out of the surrounding forest a tree at a time, and kept clear by decades of foot traffic. There is a tiny moat moving along that road that looks, from this distance, like a person walking downhill. But it can't be. No sane person would stay so close to an active deadly blow that had already killed thousands. She squints more, moving to the ship's stern so that she can continue to peer that way as the Klausu peels away from the coast. If only she had one of Inan's spy glasses, if only she could be sure. Because for a moment she thinks, for a moment she sees or hallucinates in her weariness or imagines in her anxiety. The Fulcrum seniors would not leave such a brewing disaster unmitigated, unless they thought there was a very good reason to do so. Unless they had been ordered to do so. That the walking figure is wearing a burgundy uniform. Some say the Earth is angry, because he wants no company. I say the Earth is angry, because he lives alone. Ancient, pre-imperial folk song. 21. You're getting the band back together. You say suddenly to Tonki, who is not Tonki. Tonki, who is approaching one of the crystal walls with a gleaming eye and a tiny chisel she's produced from somewhere, stops and looks at you in confusion. What? It's the end of the day, and you're tired. Discovering impossible calms hidden in giant underground geodes takes a lot out of you. Yika's people have put you and the others up in an apartment that's situated along the midpoint of one of the longer crystalline shafts. You had to walk across a rope bridge and around an encircling wooden platform to reach it. The apartment is level, even though the crystal itself isn't. The people who hollowed this place out seem not to have understood that no one forgets they're living in something that leans at a 45-degree angle, just because the floor is straight. But you've tried to put it out of your mind. And somewhere, in the middle of looking around the place and putting your pack down and thinking, This is home until I can escape it. You've suddenly realized that you know Tonki. You've known her on some level all along.
Binoff, leadership, humanus, you snap. And each word seems to hit Tonki like a blow. She flinches and takes a step back, then another, then a third, until she's pressed against the apartment's smooth crystalline wall. The look on her face is one of horror, or perhaps sorrow so great that it might as well be horror. Past a certain point, it's all the same thing.
I didn't think you remembered, she says in a small voice. You get to your feet, palms planted on the table.
It's not chance that you started traveling with us. It can't be.
Tonki tries to smile. It's a grimace. Unlikely circumstances do happen. Not with you. Not with a child who scammed her way into the fulcrum and uncovered a secret that culminated in the death of a guardian. The woman who was that child will not leave things to chance. You're sure of it. At least your rusting disguises have gotten better over the years. Hoa, who's been standing at the entrance of the apartment, guarding again, you think, turns his head from one to the other of you, back and forth. Perhaps he is watching how this confrontation goes, to prepare for the one you have to have with him next.
Tonki looks away. She's shaking just a little. It isn't a coincidence. I mean, she takes a deep breath. I haven't been following you. I had people follow you, but that's different. Didn't start following you myself until just the last few years.
You had people follow me for almost 30 years? She blinks, then relaxes a little, chuckling. It sounds bitter.
My family has more money than the Emperor. Anyway, it was easy for the first 20 years or so. We almost lost you 10 years ago, but, well.
You slam your hands down on the table, and maybe it's your imagination that the crystal walls of the apartment glow a little brighter just for a moment. This almost distracts you. Almost.
I really can't take many more surprises right now, you say, half through your teeth.
Tonki sighs and slumps against the wall.
Sorry.
You shake your head so hard that your locks slip loose from their knot.
I don't want apologies. Explain. Which are you, the innovator or the leader?
Both.
You're going to ice her. She sees that in your eyes and blurts, I was born leadership. I really was. I'm Binoff, but...
She spreads her hands.
What can I lead? I'm not good at things like that. You saw what I was like as a child. No subtlety. I'm not good with people. Things, though. Things I can do. I'm not interested in your rusting history, but it's relevant. History is always relevant.
Tonki, Binoff, or whoever she is, steps away from the wall, a pleading look on her face.
I really am a geomist. I really did go to Seventh, although... Although...
She grimaces in a way you don't understand.
It didn't go well. But I really have spent my life studying that thing, that socket, which we found in the fulcrum. Essun. Do you know what that was?
I don't care. At this, however, Tonki Binoff scowls.
It matters, she says.
Now she's the one who looks furious, and you're the one who draws back in surprise.
I've given my life to that secret. It matters. And it should matter to you, too. Because you're one of the only people in all the stillness who can make it matter.
What in earth fires are you talking about? It's where they built them.
Binoff Tonki comes forward quickly, her face alight.
The socket in the fulcrum. That's where the obelisks come from. And it's also where everything went wrong.
You end up doing introductions again. Completely this time.
Tonki is really Binoff. But she prefers Tonki, which is the name she took for herself upon getting into the 7th university.
Turns out it's not done for a child of a Eumenesian leadership to go into any profession except politics, adjudication, or large-scale merchantry. It's also not done for a child who was born a boy to be a girl. Apparently, the leadership families don't use breeders. They breed among themselves. And Tonki's girlness scuttled an arranged marriage or two. They could have simply arranged different marriages. But between that and the young Tonki's tendency to say things she shouldn't and do things that made no sense, it was the last straw. Thus, Tonki's family buried her in the stillness's finest center of learning, giving her a new persona and a false use cast, and quietly disowned her, without all the fuss and bother of a scandal. Yet Tonki thrived there, apart from a few raging fights with renowned scholars, most of which she won. When she has spent her professional life studying the obsession that drove her to the fulcrum all those years ago. The obelisks.
It wasn't so much that I was interested in you, she explains. I mean, I was. You helped me. And I needed to make sure you didn't suffer for that. That's how it started. But as I investigated you, I learned that you had potential. You were one of those who might one day develop the ability to command obelisks. It's a rare skill, see? And, well, I hoped. Well,
by this point you've sat down again, and both your voices have lowered. You can't sustain anger over this. There's too much to deal with right now. You look at Hoa, who's standing at the edge of the room, watching the two of you, his posture wary. Still gotta have that talk with him. All the secrets are coming out. Including yours. I died, you say. That was the only way to hide from the fulcrum. I died to get away from them, and yet I didn't shake you.
Well, yes. My people didn't use mysterious powers to track you. We used deduction. Much more reliable.
Tonki eases herself into the chair opposite you at the table. The apartment has 3 rooms, this den-like central space, and 2 bedrooms leading off. Tonki needs one room to herself because she's starting to smell again. You're only willing to keep sharing your space with Hoa after you get some answers, so you might be sleeping here in the den for a while.
For the past few years, I've been working with some people.
Tonki abruptly looks cagey, which isn't hard for her.
Other mests, mostly, who've also been asking the kind of questions no one wants to answer. Specialists in other areas. We've been tracking the obelisks, all of them that we can, for the past few years. Did you notice? There are patterns in the way they move. They converge slowly, wherever there is an origin of sufficient skill nearby. Someone who can use them. Only 2 were moving toward you in Torimo, but that was enough to extrapolate.
You look up, frowning.
Moving toward me?
Or another origin in your vicinity, yes.
Tonki's relaxed now, eating a piece of dried fruit from her pack, oblivious to your reaction as you stare at her, your blood gone cold. The triangulation lines were pretty clear. Torimo was the center of the circle, so to speak. You must have been there for years. One of the obelisks coming toward you had been traveling the same flight path for almost a decade. All the way from the eastern coast.
The amethyst, you whisper.
Yes.
Tonki watches you.
That was why I suspected you were still alive. Obelisks. Bond, sort of. to certain origins. I don't know how that works. I don't know why, but it's specific and predictable.
Deduction. You shake your head, mute with shock, and she goes on.
Anyhow, they'd both picked up speed in the last 2 or 3 years, so I traveled to the region and pretended to be calmless to get a better read on them. I never really meant to approach you, but then this thing happened up north, and I started to think it would be important to have a wielder, obelisk wielder, around. So I tried to find you. I was on my way to Terima when I spotted you at that roadhouse. Lucky. I was going to trail you for a few days, decide whether I'd tell you who I really was. But then he turned a Kirkuza into a statue. She jerks her head at Hoa. Figured it might be better to shut up and observe for a while instead.
Somewhat understandable. You said more than one obelisk was headed for Terima.
You lick your lips.
There should have only been one. The amethyst is the only one you're connected to, the only one left.
There were two. The amethyst, and another from the Murs. That's a big desert to the northeast.
You shake your head. I've never been to the Murs.
Tonki is silent for a moment, perhaps intrigued, perhaps annoyed. Well, how many origins were in Terima?
3, but picked up speed. You can't think all of a sudden, can't answer her question, can't muster complete sentences. Picked up speed in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yes. We didn't know what was causing that.
Tonki pauses, then gives you a sidelong look, her eyes narrowing.
Do you?
Uche was 2 years old, almost 3.
Get out, you whisper. Go take a bath or something, I need to think.
She hesitates, plainly wanting to ask more questions. But then you look up at her and she immediately gets up to leave. A few minutes after, she's out of the apartment, with the heavy hanging falling in her wake. The apartments in this place have no doors, but the hangings work well enough for privacy. You sit there in silence, your head empty for a while. Then, you look up at Hoa, who's standing beside Tonki's vacated chair, plainly waiting his turn.
So you're a stone eater, you say.
He nods, solemn.
You look. You gesture at him, not sure how to say it. He's never looked normal, not really, but he's definitely not what a stone eater is supposed to look like. Their hair does not move, their skin does not bleed. They transit through solid rock in the span of a breath, but stares would take them hours.
Hoa shifts a little, bringing his pack up into his lap. He rummages for a moment, and then comes out with the rag-wrapped bundle that you haven't seen for a while. So that's where he put it. He unties it, finally letting you see what he's been carrying all this time. The bundle contains many smallish pieces of rough-hewn crystal, as far as you can tell. Something like quartz, or maybe gypsum, except some of the pieces are not murky white, but Venus red. And you're not sure, but you think the bundle is smaller now than it used to be. Did he lose some of them?
Rocks, you say. You've been carrying rocks?
Hoa hesitates, then reaches for one of the white pieces. He picks it up. It's about the size of the tip of your thumb, squarish, chipped badly on one side. It looks hard.
He eats it. You stare and he watches you while he does it.
He works it around in his mouth for a moment, as if searching for the right angle of attack, or maybe he's just rolling it around on his tongue, enjoying the taste. Maybe it's salt. But then his jaw flexes. There's a crunching sound, surprisingly loud in the silence of the room. Several more crunches, not as loud, but leaving no doubt that what he's chewing on is by no means food. And then he swallows,
and licks his lips. It's the first time you've ever seen him eat.
Food, you say.
Me.
He extends a hand and lays it over the pile of rocks with curious delicacy.
You frown a little because he's making less sense than usual.
So that's what? Something that allows you to look like one of us?
Which you didn't know they could do.
Then again, stone eaters share nothing of themselves and they do not tolerate inquiry from others.
You've read accounts of attempts by the Sixth University at Arkara to capture a stone eater for study 2 seasons back. The result was the Seventh University at D-Bars, which got built only after they dug enough books out of the rubble of Sixth.
Crystalline structures are an efficient storage medium.
The words make no sense. Then Hoa repeats clearly,
"This is me."
You want to ask more about that, then decide against it. If he wanted you to understand, he would have explained, and that's not the part that matters anyway.
Why, you ask, why did you make yourself like this? Why not just be what you are?
Hoa gives you a look so skeptical that you realize what a stupid question that is. Would you really have let him travel with you if you'd known what he was? Then again, if you'd known what he was, you wouldn't have tried to stop him. No one stops stone eaters from doing what they damn well please.
Why bother, I mean, you ask. Can't you just... Your kind can travel through stone.
Yes, but I wanted to travel with you.
And here we come to the crux of it.
Why?
I like you.
And then he shrugs.
Shrugs? Like any child, upon being asked something he either doesn't know how to articulate or doesn't want to try. Maybe it isn't important. Maybe it was just an impulse. Maybe he'll wander off eventually, following some other whim. Only the fact that he isn't a child, that he isn't rusting human, that he's probably seasons old, that he comes from a whole race of people that can't act on whims because it's too rusting hard, makes this a lie.
You rub your face. Your hands come away gritty with ash. You need a bath, too.
As you sigh, you hear him say softly, "I won't hurt you."
You blink at this, then lower your hands slowly. It hadn't even occurred to you that he might. Even now, knowing what he is, having seen the things he can do, you're finding it hard to think of him as a frightening, mysterious, unknowable thing. And that, more than anything else, tells you why he's done this to himself. He likes you. He doesn't want you to fear him.
Good to know, you say. And then there's nothing else to say, so you just look at each other for a while.
It isn't safe here, he says then.
Figured that, yeah. The words are out, snide tone and all, before you really catch yourself. And then, well, is it really surprising that you'd be feeling a bit acerbic at this point? You've been sniping at people since Terimo, really. But then it occurs to you, that's not the way you were with Jija or anyone else before Uche's death. Back then, you were always careful to be gentler, calmer, never sarcastic. If you got angry, you didn't let it show. That's not who Esun was supposed to be.
Yeah, well, you're not quite Esun. Not just Esun. Not anymore. The others like you who are here, you begin. His little face tightens, though, in unmistakable anger. You stop in surprise.
They aren't like me, he says coldly.
Well, that's that, then, and you're done. I need to rest, you say.
You've been walking all day, and much as you'd like to bathe too, you're not sure you're ready to undress and make yourself any more vulnerable in front of these Kastrima people. Especially given that they're apparently taking you captive in their nice, understated way. Hoa nods. He starts gathering up his bundle of rocks again.
I'll keep watch.
Do you sleep?
Occasionally. Less than you. I don't need to do it now.
How convenient. And you trust him more than you do the people of this calm. You shouldn't. But you do. So you get up and head into the bedroom and lie down on the mattress. It's a simple thing. Just straw and cotton packed into a canvas sheath. But it's better than the hard ground or even your bedroll. So you flop onto it. In seconds, you're asleep. When you wake, you're not sure how much time has passed. Hoa is curled up beside you, as he has done for the past few weeks. You sit up and frown down at him. He blinks at you, warily. You shake your head, finally, and get up, muttering to yourself. Tonki's back in her room. You can hear her snoring. As you step out of the apartment, you realize you have no idea what time it is. Topside, you can tell if it's day or night, even despite the clouds and ashfall. It's either bright ashfall and clouds, or dark, red-flecked ashfall and clouds. Here, though, you look around and see nothing but giant glowing crystals, and the town that people have impossibly built on them. You step onto the rough wooden platform outside your door and squint down over its completely inadequate safety railing. Whatever the hour, it seems there are several dozen people going about their business on the ground below. Well, you need to know more about this comm anyway. Before you destroy it, that is, if they really try to stop you from leaving. You ignore the small voice in your head that whispers, Ika is a Raga too. Will you really fight her? You're pretty good at ignoring small voices. Figuring out how to reach the ground level is difficult at first, because all the platforms and bridges and stairways of the place are built to connect the crystals. The crystals go every which way, so the connections do too. There's nothing intuitive about it. You have to follow one set of stairs up and walk around one of the wider crystal shafts in order to find another set of stairs that goes down, only to find that they end on a platform with no steps at all, which forces you to backtrack. There are a few people out and about, and they look at you with curiosity or hostility in passing, probably because you're so obviously new in town. They're clean and you're gray with road ash. They look well-fleshed. And your clothes hang off your body because you've done nothing but walk and eat travel rations for weeks. You cannot help resenting them on sight. So you get stubborn about asking for directions. Eventually, however, you make it to the ground. Down here, it's more obvious than ever that you're walking along the floor of a huge stone bubble, because the ground slopes gently downward and curves around you to form a noticeable, if vast, bowl. This is the pointy end of the ovoid that is Kastrima. There are crystals down here, too, but they're stubby, some only as high as your chest. The largest are only 10 or 15 feet tall. Wooden partitions wend around some of them, and in some places you can make out obvious patches of rough, paler ground, where crystals have been removed to make room. You wonder, idly, how they did this. All of it creates a sort of maze of crisscrossing pathways, each of which leads to some calm essential or another. A kiln, a smithy, a glassery, a bakehouse. Off some of the paths, you glimpse tents and campsites, some occupied. Clearly not all the denizens of this calm are comfortable walking along bundles of lashed-together wooden planks, hundreds of feet above a floor covered in giant spikes. Funny, that. There it is again. That un-Essen-like sarcasm.
Rustet, you're tired of reining it in.
It's actually easy to find the baths, because there's a pattern of damp foot traffic along the gray-green stone floor, all the wet footprints leading in one direction. You backtrail them, and are pleasantly surprised to find that the bath is a huge pool of steaming clear water. The pool has been walled off a little above the natural floor of the geode, and there is a channel wending away from it, draining into one of several large brass pipes going somewhere. On the other side of the pool, you can see a kind of waterfall emerging from another pipe to supply the pool. The water probably circulates enough to be clean every few hours or so, but nevertheless, there's a conspicuous washing area over to one side, with long wooden benches and shelves holding various accessories. Quite a few people are already there, busily scrubbing before they go into the larger pool. You're undressed and halfway done with your own scrubbing when a shadow falls over you, and you twitch and stumble to your feet and knock over the bench and reach for the earth before it occurs to you that maybe this is overreacting. But then you almost drop the soapy sponge in your hand because it's Lerna.
Yes, he says as you stare at him. I thought that might be you, Essen.
You keep staring. He looks different somehow, heavier, sort of, though skinnier too in the same way you are. Travel-worn. It's been weeks, months. You're losing track of time. And what is he doing here? He should be back in Terimo. Rask would never let a doctor go. Oh, right.
So Yika did manage to summon you. I'd wondered.
Tired. He looks tired. There's a scar along the edge of his jaw, a crescent-shaped pale patch that doesn't look likely to regain its color. You keep staring as he shifts and says,
of all the places I had to end up, and here you are. Maybe this is fate, or maybe there really are gods other than Father Earth. Ones who actually give a damn about us, that is. Or maybe they're evil too, and this is their joke.
Rust if I know. Lerna, you say, which is helpful. His eyes flick down, and belatedly you remember you're naked.
I should let you finish, he says, looking away quickly. Let's talk when you're done.
You don't care if he sees your nudity. He delivered one of your children for Rust's sake. But he's being polite. It's a familiar habit of his, treating you like a person even though he knows what you are. And oddly heartening after so much strangeness and everything that's changed in your life. You're not used to having a life follow you when you leave it behind. He moves off, past the bath area, and after a moment you sit back down and finish washing. No one else bothers you while you bathe, although you catch some of the Kostrima people eyeing you with increased curiosity now. Less hostility, too. But that's not surprising. You don't look especially intimidating. It's the stuff they can't see that will make them hate you. Then again, do they know what Ika is? The blonde woman who'd been with her up on the surface certainly does. Maybe Ika's got something on her, some means of ensuring her silence. That doesn't feel right, though. Ika is too open about what she is. Too comfortable speaking of it to complete strangers. She's too charismatic, too eye-catching. Ika acts like being an origin is just another talent, just another personal trait. You've only seen that kind of attitude and this kind of calm, wide acceptance of it once before. Once you're done soaking and you feel clean, you get out of the bath. You don't have any towels. Just your filthy, ashen clothes, which you take the time to scrub clean in the washing area. They're wet when you're done, but you're not quite bold enough to walk around through a strange calm naked. And it feels like summer within the geode anyway. So, as you do in summer, you put the wet clothes on, figuring they'll dry fast enough. Lerna's waiting when you leave.
This way, he says, turning to walk with you.
So you follow him, and he leads you up the maze of steps and platforms until you reach a squat gray crystal that juts only 20 feet or so from the wall. He's got an apartment here that's smaller than the one you share with Tonki and Hoa, but you see shelves laden with herb packets and folded bandages, and it's not hard to guess that the odd benches in the main room might actually be intended as makeshift cots. A doctor must be prepared for house calls. He directs you to sit down on one of the benches and sits across from you.
I left Terimo the day after you did, he says quietly. Oyamar, Rask's second, you remember him, complete idiot, was actually trying to hold an election for a new headman. Didn't want the responsibility with a season coming on. Everybody knew Rask should never have picked him, but his family did Rask a favor on the trade rights to the Western logging trace. He trails off, because none of that matters anymore. Anyway, half the damned Strungbacks were running around drunk and armed, raiding the store caches, accusing every other person of being a Raga or a Raga lover. The other half were doing the same thing, quieter though, and sober, which was worse. I knew it was only a matter of time till they thought about me. Everybody knew I was your friend.
This is your fault too, then. Because of you, he had to flee a place that should have been safe. You lower your eyes, uncomfortable. He's using the word Raga now, too.
I was thinking I could make it down to Brilliance, where my mother's family came from. They barely know me, but they know of me, and I'm a doctor, so I figured I had a chance. Better than staying in Terimo anyway to get lynched. Or to starve. When the cold came and the Strongbacks had eaten or stolen everything. And I thought...
He hesitates, looks up at you in a flash of eyes, then back at his hands.
I also thought I might catch up to you on the road if I went fast enough. But that was stupid. Of course I didn't.
It's the unspoken thing that's always been between you. Lerna figured out what you were. Sometime during your time in Terimo, you didn't tell him. He figured it out because he watched you enough to notice the signs, and because he's smart. He's always liked you, Makenba's boy. You figured he would grow out of it eventually. You shift a little, uncomfortable with the realization that he hasn't.
I slipped out in the night, he continues. Through one of the cracks in the wall near where you, where they tried to stop you.
He's got his arms resting on his knees, looking at his folded hands. They're mostly still, but he rubs one thumb along the knuckle of the other, slowly, again and again. The gesture feels meditative.
Walked with the flow of people, following a map I had, but I've never been to Brilliance. Earth fires. I barely left Terimo before now. Just once, really, when I went to finish my medical training at Hilga. Anyway. Either the map was wrong or I'm bad at reading it, probably both. I didn't have a compass. I got off the Imperial Road too soon, maybe. Went southeast when I thought I was going due south. I don't know.
He sighs and rubs a hand over his head. By the time I figured out just how lost I was, I'd gone so far that I hoped to just find a better route if I kept going the way I'd gone. But there was a group at one crossroads. Bandits. Calmless something. I was with a small group by then. An older man who'd had a bad gash on his chest that I treated. And his daughter, maybe 15. Bandits. He pauses, his jaw flexing.
You can pretty much guess what happened. Lerna's not a fighter.
He's still alive, though, which is all that matters.
Marold, that was the man. Just threw himself at one of them. He didn't have weapons or anything. And the woman had a machete. I don't know what he thought he could do.
Lerna takes a deep breath.
He looked at me, though, and I grabbed his daughter and ran.
His jaw tightens further.
You're surprised you can't hear his teeth grinding.
She left me later, called me a coward, and ran off alone.
If you hadn't taken her away, you say, they would have killed you and her, too.
This is Stone Lore. Honor in safety, survival under threat. Better a living coward than a dead hero.
Lerna's lips quirk thinly.
That's what I told myself at the time. Later, when she left, Earth fires. Maybe all I did was just delay the inevitable.
A girl her age, unarmed, and out on the roads alone?
You don't say anything. If the girl's healthy and has the right confirmation, someone will take her in, if only as a breeder. If she has a better use name, or if she can acquire a weapon and supplies and prove herself, that will help too. Granted, her chances would have been better with Lerna than without him. But she made her choice.
I don't even know what they wanted.
Lerna's looking at his hands.
Maybe he's been eating himself up about this ever since.
We didn't have anything but our runny sacks.
That's enough. If they were running low on supplies, you say. Before you remember to censure yourself, he doesn't seem to hear anyway.
So I kept on by myself.
He chuckles once, bitterly.
I was so worried about her, it didn't even occur to me that I was just as bad off.
This is true. Lerna is a bog-standard mid-ladder, same as you. Except he hasn't inherited the sons at bulk or height. Probably why he's worked so hard to prove his mental fitness. But he's ended up pretty, mostly by an accident of heritage. And some people breed for that. Sabaki long nose, Sun's Edge shoulders and coloring, West Coaster lips. He's too multiracial for equatorial calm tastes. But by Somidlat standards, he's a looker.
When I passed through Kostrima, he continues, it looked abandoned. I was exhausted after running from... Anyway. Figured I'd hole up and... one of the houses for the night, maybe. Try to make a small hearth fire and hope no one noticed. Eat a decent meal for a change. Hold still long enough to figure out what to do next.
He smiled thinly.
And when I woke up, I was surrounded. I told them I was a doctor and they brought me down here. That was maybe 2 weeks ago.
You nod. And then you tell him your own story, not bothering to hide or lie about anything. The whole thing. Not just the part in Terimo.
You're feeling guilty, maybe.
He deserves the whole truth. After you've both fallen silent for a while, Lerna just shakes his head and sighs.
I didn't expect to live through a season, he says softly.
I mean, I've heard the lore all my life, same as everyone else. But I always figured it would never happen to me.
Everyone thinks that. You certainly weren't expecting to have to deal with the end of the world on top of everything else.
Nossun's not here, Lerna says after a while. He speaks softly, but your head jerks up.
His face softens at the look that must be on yours.
I'm sorry, but I've been here long enough to meet all the other newcomers to this calm. I know that's who you've been hoping to find.
No Nossun. And now no direction. No realistic way to find her.
You are suddenly bereft of even hope.
Esun.
Lerna leans forward abruptly and takes your hands. Belatedly you realize your hands have begun shaking. His fingers still yours.
You'll find her.
The words are meaningless. Reflexive, gibberish, intended to